Hurry up.
Hurry up. Hurry up.
Can't waste time.
Hurry up.
Can't waste time.
When you're racing with the clock. When you're racing with the clock. And the second hand doesn't understand that your back may break and your fingers ache and your constitution isn't made of rock.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
I'm not claiming that it's just as simple as Hollywood hates the working class, though that might also be true. It's just not that simple. Right. Because Hollywood needs working class people to come to see its films.
That's Kathy Newman, Associate Professor of English at Carnegie Mellon University. Her book, Striking Images, Labor on Screen and in the Streets in the 1950s, combines cultural analysis with labor history, which she talks about this week with Labor History Today's Sherry Lincoln. In this week's Labor History, in June of 1972, sales clerk Laura Collins decided to buy some chicken. Chicken that she planned to donate, along with a cake, to a church dinner. She had no idea that this decision and the demands for union representation would take her name all the way to the Supreme Court. Later in the show, Saul Schneiderman explains how. Here's the show. In the last few years, the working class has gained a lot of visibility in pop culture, and just last week, American Factory and Parasite, two very class-conscious films, both won Academy Awards. Kathy Newman is Associate Professor of English at Carnegie Mellon University and author of Striking Images, Labor on Screen and in the Streets in the 1950s. Newman challenges the idea that portrayals of unions and working-class life in the movies and on television are few and far between, arguing that
I think there is always culture being made about working class people.
Newman was on Labor History Today back in December talking about the working class origins of Christmas, and she's a regular contributor to the Working Class Perspectives blog, edited by Sherry Lincoln and housed at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. Here's Sherry.
I'm delighted to welcome Kathy Newman back to Labor History Today to talk about her research on how organized labor was portrayed in the mass culture of the mid-20th century. In the last few years, the working class has gained a lot of visibility in pop culture. We've seen print media, but also some recent award-winning films, things like Parasite, Joker, and American Factory. But for most of today's mass media, we just don't see much on the place of unions in working class life. For compelling stories about that, we have to look back at least a few decades. Kathy, you've been digging into that history with a focus on the 1950s. In fact, you've described that period, I love this phrase, as the decade the unions made. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think I got interested in this project because I was noticing that two films won Best Picture in the 1950s, On the Waterfront and Marty. And they're both black and white, and they're gritty, and they're about working class people. And On the Waterfront's more specifically about unions. Marty is more tangentially about unions. But we have this idea that the 1950s was all about middle class people and middle class stories, and I Love Lucy, and white picket fences, and moving to the suburbs, and barbecues. And I just wasn't seeing that in some of the culture that I was getting interested in. So I wanted to figure out, why is there this kind of story about the 50s, and yet there are these well-known, really popular, really important films that everybody thinks are great that tell a different story.
And I think it's true that the 1950s was a period when unions were in the U.S. making a lot of gains. There was a lot of union activity. What kinds of things were happening in that decade? I know that's a huge question, but give us a little bit of history lesson about the 1950s and what we should be thinking about in terms of the context in which those films appeared.
Well, this is something I've tried to dig into, and there's no single historical text where I have been able to get this information. So I basically went back to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and there were more strikes in the 1950s than in any other decade in American history.
That alone is pretty amazing. Do you have any idea of why?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it's also the highest union density, the highest number of union members. It's kind of the heyday of the union movement. I mean, I think there's a weird kind of almost paradox that unions are incredibly normal in the 1950s. And they're so normal in a way that people didn't notice them. If that makes sense. Like they were just an accepted part of everyday life.
Right.
So let me give you a few statistics. And these are all basically between January of 1950 and December of 1960. I just defined the decade very formally. There were 40,966 strikes involving more than 20 million workers, averaging out to about 4,000 strikes per year, 79 strikes per week, and about 11 strikes per day. The average length of these strikes is relatively short, 15 days. So this could go to why we kind of didn't notice or we don't remember. But if we aggregate the number of worker days idled over this decade, we see that there were more than 300 million worker days idled. So that's a lot of days of people not working.
And I was going to say, it's interesting to think about that many days of people not working in a period that we think of as highly productive.
Absolutely. So you put productivity on top of this. This is sort of productivity in spite of all
right,
of this.
Right.
And there's this great quote I found in the New York Times in 1954 of somebody complaining. He said, Philip Courtney, deeply buried in the statistics by the Department of Labor, one can discover the fact that there are constantly 200,000 to 300,000 men on strike. But since these strikes are not as spectacular as those of steel companies or longshoremen or General Electric, the fact goes unnoticed by the public. So there's just this truth that there's a lot of people on strike, but we either don't remember or we didn't notice because it was so normal. And then something else that I trace is there really is an effort on the part of journalists to change the narrative about what strikes meant and how we should view them. So over the course of this decade, something I call the narrating class tried to portray unions as increasingly corrupt. And weirdly, as like they use the word boss a lot to describe strikers. So there was this attempt to create an equivalence between an actual boss, a corporate boss, and a labor boss, that these are basically the two bad guys in the 1950s, and consumers especially are sort of squeezed between them. So consumers are kind of the victims of these sort of fights between these two kinds of bosses, and both are bullies, both are kind of unsavory. Lots of pictures of John L. Lewis with his giant eyebrows kind of representing labor in this period as this sort of mean guys to the consumers who are just trying to get to work or just trying to buy a case of beer.
So it's interesting to think about that, because if we cast union leaders in particular as almost like gangsters, that might set up the idea that unions make for good entertainment. Is that part of what generates TV shows and movies that actually tell union stories? Or are people in the film and TV industries pushing back on that narrative?
I mean, I think this is tricky business, and it's kind of hard to sort it out. I think there's a book I really love that explains how and where mob influence becomes increasingly present. It's much more present in AFL unions and CIO unions, sort of those older craft unions. And it's called The More Perfect Union is the name of the book. And it's an attempt to explain how working class people essentially need some of the protections that corporations have in order to kind of fight in this world, to kind of fight over capitalism.
And so I think there's a truth, there's a reality that there is some mob union interconnection in this period. It's just undoubtedly true. It's a fact. But then I think there's two things that follow from that. One is that Hollywood sensationalizes this in part to discredit unions. But there's also a very long tradition within films, films about working class people that are also about mobsters, that mobsters, gangsters come from the working class. So there's a way in which there's still a kind of almost romantic view of working class people and mobs in this way. So it's not all negative. So the narrating class loves to say unions are crooked. But Hollywood, I think, knows that it has a working class audience. And so mobsters are the working class people that they can easily portray and that are also involved in all these exciting scandals, murders, things that movies tend to get made about. So I'm not claiming that it's just as simple as Hollywood hates the working class, though that might also be true. It's just not that simple.
Right.
Because Hollywood needs working class people to come to see its films.
Right. And you have some really interesting things in the bits of your work that I've read on this about the growing awareness of the working class as an audience to appeal to. Can you tell us a little bit more about where that comes from and how it works?
I mean, something is really shifting in a seismic way around media consumption in this decade because of the television. Americans of all classes are staying at home and watching TV. It's a high point for movie attendance, and this is a fact that gets repeated all the time in the scholarship, is 1946. So it's after the war and before what's called the Paramount decision, where studios have to get out of the business of owning theaters. And it's before television. And I think something like 90 million people a week go to the movies. And that was sort of the last high point in American history for movie goership. So studios are trying to then recruit. This is what I call the move from broadcasting to narrowcasting. When you can't get everybody, you have to get a group of people. And you have to get a group of people by sort of matching the content of the film with the audience you're trying to reach. And so increasingly there's all kinds of sub-communities, subgroups that studios are trying to recruit by making certain kinds of films. So this is the big decade of Disney films and people bringing their kids to the movies increasingly and going as a family as opposed to sending your kid down the street to a film with a nickel on Saturday morning, which was more typical in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. So families become a group, adults become a group, working class viewers become a group, women become increasingly a group. So it's how do you get people to leave the house in the evening, get away from the television, and go into the theater? And that becomes a real marketing problem for the studios.
It's interesting to think of the working class as one of those groups that would be targeted, because I think the ways we think about marketing of media more recently, it seems always to be going after the people who have the most disposable income. We don't think of workers necessarily as the people with the most money to spend, but clearly we have to be wrong about that if we're thinking about a period when the working class becomes a desirable market. How does that happen?
Well, there's a little bit of a struggle over it. I mean, that's what I'm sort of interested in, because there's PR folks who are kind of inventing their profession in this time, who are waving all these flags and saying to Hollywood, there's this incredible market that you're ignoring. And not only do these people have money to spend, but they're pro-union, because Hollywood is pro-union. So there's a group of marketers that make a very explicit pitch to Hollywood in 1957 to say, we really need to be focusing on this group more in our stories. I mean, in some ways, I don't think that Hollywood really figures this out fully. I'm not arguing that there's a full-blown kind of understanding of the working class as a market. But there's a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of frustration and a lot of trying to figure out what's going to bring people out. So I think the working class gets kind of imagined more as adults. how do you get adults to leave the house? And then that adult audience gets kind of carved up into kind of higher and lower classes in terms of taste. So there's less of an admission of exactly what you said, but more of an admission that there's a problem, and then of a lot of experiment, both with different kinds of movies and also different kinds of marketing campaigns.
Right. So a lot of your work in this, in kind of taking these ideas about the larger patterns and developing a full analysis of it, a lot of that involves finding and watching television shows and movies that I think a lot of us might not remember. And I think we probably don't remember, and maybe I'm wrong about this, I think we probably don't remember the TV even more than we don't remember the movies, because the movies are more likely to have survived or rerun. I may be completely wrong about that, and tell me if I'm making a huge mistake. But I'd really love to have you kind of take us with you into the archives and maybe start with television and fill us in a little bit on what kind of things we would have seen in the 1950s on TV about working class people, about work, about unions. What does that look like?
That's actually still something I'm trying to figure out, which is why actually this project focuses more on movies. I'm working on a digital humanities project with a graduate student where we're trying to kind of map the great mass of television that was not saved either on film or kinescope. So how do you do that? Well, we're doing it through text.
Okay.
Like, you know, descriptions of shows.
Right.
So I have kind of a gut feeling that there was more working class content on television, but it's very difficult to prove.
Right.
Because so little of it survived. I can throw out a few things. So The Honeymooners. And what's important about The Honeymooners, which of course everybody knows and remembers, is that it was only a standalone sitcom for 1 year, and it wasn't actually that popular that year. It was more popular in circulation. But on Jackie Gleason's show, which ran pretty much from 51 to 56, and then the standalone show ran from 56 to 57, he did The Honeymooners as a bit on his variety show, and it was the most popular bit that he did. And so that's when they pulled it out and made it a standalone sitcom. They thought they would be more successful than they were.
It's interesting. Do you have any theory about why it worked in the context of the variety show and not so much of the standalone?
It was up against Perry Como.
Oh.
So it was partly just it was a slot problem. I think it wasn't slotted in the right place.
Right.
But I think there was also people really liked Jackie Gleason pretending to be these characters, but I think as entertainment, it worked a little bit less well in that very particular year, but I think it's never been off the air since 1957. The Classic 39, that's what they're called. Those 39 episodes are playing today somewhere in America.
Yeah, just so amazing.
It is. So I think that he created something that has incredible longevity because it did tell a certain kind of truth about what ordinary people were going through. A lot of his jokes are about losing a job. A lot of them are about being poorly treated on the job. A lot of them are about taxes. A lot of them are about rent. There's this episode that nobody has ever talked about that I've seen where he and Alice go on a rent strike.
He doesn't scare me. He's bluffing.
Ralph, you're not serious about this.
I was never more serious in my life. I know a bluff when I see a bluff.
He's a bluffing bluffer, bluffer.
Say that again. Bluff. Don't worry. When Norton and I lock ourselves up in our apartments, we'll see who's bluffing.
No, it's all right. For me and you, lock ourselves in. Hey, wait a minute. I thought you was in this by yourself.
What do you mean, in it by myself? You and I have to fight for a cause. Don't forget, if we both lock ourselves in our apartment, we're stronger. In unity, there is strength.
Oh, wow.
And the episode ends with them with all of their furniture on the street, and it's snowing.
Oh, my. That's pretty dramatic for a sitcom.
It's pretty dramatic and not very funny. I mean, it's like a very dark episode.
Right.
So that's a show that I think tells a certain kind of story. Queen for a Day. is probably the most popular, maybe best remembered game show that always features working class women. So it's three women come and tell their sob stories, and then the audience decides which one of them is going to be queen for the day. And they get a cash prize. They get they wear a little fur regal coat. They get a crown, and then they get a whole bunch of products that are sponsoring the show. Dishwashers, dish soap, that sort of thing. So Queen for a Day is one of the places where working class people appeared basically every day. It was a very popular, long-running game show.
And interestingly, appear primarily as consumers.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Well, it was consumer problems, consumer
right.
answers to working class problems.
Oh, there
you
go.
So, a husband has died, and so the woman can't support her family. A child has some kind of terrible illness. I mean, they were all working class problems of precarity and poor health care that, the washing machine is going to fix.
We'll be back with the rest of our interview with Kathy Newman in a moment. Here's Saul Schneiderman with this week's Labor History.
Hello, this is Saul Schneiderman calling from Tacoma Park on February 19th. 1975, the United States Supreme Court decides in favor of sales clerk Laura Collins and her union, the retail clerk, in the famous case, the NLRB versus Jay Weingarten. And this is the case that established that workers have the right to have their union steward present if they're going to be disciplined for a workplace infraction, a very important workplace right. And all of this happened in the Weingarten store. That was a food service operation, and a young woman named Laura Collins was being interviewed about whether or not she had apparently stolen some chicken by putting it in a particular box and what she paid for it. Was it a dollar box or a $3 box or whatever? She felt something was going on that was going to be detrimental to her employment, so she kept requesting over and over again to have a union steward present. And they refused. And eventually, in this case, ended up in the Supreme Court, which ruled that a worker has the right to have a union rep present. And so, in workplaces around the United States where there is a union, many stewards and business reps have little cards that they hand out to workers. And at the top, it says Weingarten rights. And it says something like this. I request to have a union representative present on my behalf during this meeting because I believe it may lead to disciplinary action being taken against me. If I am denied my right to have a union rep present, I will refuse to answer accusational questions and any I believe may lead to discipline. That's the famous Weingarten right, which was established this week in labor history.
Here's the rest of our interview with Kathy Newman about the portrayal of the working class on television and in the movies. Here's Labor History Today's Sherry Lincoln.
So if movies are the heart, take us to the movies. You mentioned before On the Waterfront and Marty, so maybe we can start with films like that are the ones that people know but maybe not have thought about in the context of representations of working class people and of labor during the 1950s. How should we be thinking about those films?
Yeah, I hope that people will be thinking more about them when they read this book, and more critically in the sense that On the Waterfront is in every single film textbook. I've seen literally hundreds of references. The film is told as Elia Kazan's middle finger to all of his former friends and allies in the Communist Party. So that's Elia Kazan said that in his autobiography in 1983. He said, I'm Terry Malloy. I said, I'm glad what I done. I'm glad I named names. And this movie is my flag, my banner of saying that. So that's how the movie's read. And so what people ignore is the fact that there were dozens of labor struggles, strikes, mob murders against strong union activists for years, for decades on the waterfront. And in the early 1950s, it was 3-inch headline daily news. it was news that captivated and dominated the New York media and to some extent the national media. So if you walked in to see On the Waterfront in 1954, you were not thinking about the blacklist. You were thinking about the fact that a shipment of cutting-edge fashionable dresses was delayed because there was another strike on the waterfront that day. That's what you would be thinking about. So that's just a historical context we've lost that I'm trying to sort of put back into that story.
Right, that makes sense. I wonder if you're also finding or reminding us of other films that were that came out during that period that people today might not even remember that those films existed. What else should we be looking for if we're going back through, you know, old film collections and trying to find things to look at to understand how people saw these things in the 1950s? What else is out there?
Yeah, there's a new term that's come up. Some people call it an orphan film. So it's a film that's kind of a one-off or not very well remembered. And your listeners will have remembered Salt of the Earth, which is the one kind of working class film made in the 50s that everybody talks about. But they will not have remembered A Whistle at Eaton Falls, which was made by this very weird producer, DeRoche, I have to go back to look at his name. But it stars people that then went on to become extremely famous, like Ernest Borgnine. So it's a film about a strike in a plastics factory. It was not popular. It was not successful. It did not make money. So that's it's an orphan film. It's out there. Nobody's going to remember it. But many of those characters and many of those plots get recycled and then brought into other films in the 1950s. Another film nobody will remember is Clash by Night, unless they're a Marilyn Monroe fan, because it starred her. And she plays a cannery worker. And the film was made on the heels of Steinbeck's Cannery Row as a kind of love letter to that part of the country and to that industry. But it's a melodrama about a woman who's married to a big lunk of a guy, a fisherman, and she cheats on him with a film projector, somebody who works in the film booth. And so it's not remembered, again, as an important working class film, even though it's full of these working class characters and working class themes. The Garment Jungle is a thriller used on the waterfront in its marketing. It said it's exciting as On the Waterfront. And it's about a garment factory owner who hires the mob to keep the union out of the factory. And there's some implication that maybe the union has some kind of unsavory characters in its mix, but it's really about a corporation that hires a mob. So it's corporate hired mobsters. So that film has also not been remembered, even though it was a first film for Robert Loggia, who goes on to play important working class characters, the uncle in The Godfather, The Sopranos. So he goes on to have this long, illustrious career of playing working class characters. So these are films that have been forgotten. The Garment Jungle played on 88 screens in New York City in 1957.
That's kind of amazing. And it's a lot. I don't know how many screens there would have been in New York at that time, but that suggests that it was seen by a lot of people.
It was seen by a lot of people, and there's about 250,000, 300,000 garment workers in New York City in that period.
Right. So this is a film about them.
It is, and specifically it was inspired by the murder of a garment worker organizer who was murdered by the mob in 1949. And that murder was front page news. People tried to turn it into a movie a half a dozen times before it finally became The Garment Jungle in 1957.
That's a great story. So when we're speaking about the garment industry, I want to ask you a little bit about the pajama game, which is probably the best known musical to come out of this era that reflects all of this. Can you tell us a little bit about that one? Because that's, I feel like that's in between the, you know, the On the Waterfront that everybody knows and the Garment Jungle that we haven't heard about at all. You know, people know some of the songs from it. Maybe they know a little bit about it. Fill us in on that one, please.
Yeah, and this is such a fun musical, and Doris Day is so amazing in it. It was one of the most popular musicals on Broadway in the decade. It ran for more than 1,000 performances. Almost as soon as it closed, it then went into production as a stage musical. All of the Broadway principals were in the movie except for the main character, who was replaced by Doris Day, and she is the highest paid actress in this period. So she is the big star that they're hoping will get everybody to see the movie. It was also based on a best-selling book. So if you lived in this era, you would have read the book, you would have bought the cast album, and then you would have seen the movie. The movie opened on Labor Day, so Warner Brothers was really trying to make a connection between the labor theme and the film itself, kind of saying, yes, go see this for Labor Day. And it's fun. It's upbeat. It's silly. It's very middle brow. It doesn't have any of the grittiness of these other films that I'm talking about. But I still think, weirdly, there's a kind of pro-working class or unions as natural, unions as normal, strikes as normal, strikes as fun, strikes as colorful, strikes as cool. Like, that comes through in the song, 7.5 cents. They're asking for a 7.5 cent raise, which is not actually that much even in the 50s, but the song is about how if you add up 7.5 cents an hour and you multiply it by the number of hours you work in a week and then the number of weeks you work in a year, and you add that up over 20 years, Doris Day, in her role as Babe, suggests that then she would be able to buy the factory herself. So there's just a little bit of a sly play on the workers taking over the means of production in that song.
20 years. Now let's see. That's 1,040 weeks.
Times 40 hours every week.
And roughly 2.25 hours overtime.
A time and a half for overtime.
Comes to exactly
$3,411.96.
Wow!
That's enough for me to be a sultan in the Taj Mahal, and every room a different doll.
I'll have myself a buying spree. I'll buy a pajama factory. Then I can end up having old man Hassler work for me.
So, although 7.5 cents doesn't buy a heck of a lot, 7.5 cents doesn't mean a thing. But give it to me every hour, 40 hours every week. That's enough for me to be living my life.
There's also a gesture in that song, I think, to the workers as consumers. It kind of takes us back to that theme, because part of it is about, if I had that more money, I could spend that money. And, you know, I would have a better life, but I could also spend it. So there's an interesting way that these things fit together.
Well, definitely. And I think one of the ways that the working class is maligned by progressives, both in the era and when we look back, is that we're scolded. We're like, oh, workers wanted to work more, or wanted these better wages and benefits so that they could buy more. And we're suspicious of that. We're judgmental of that. And I want to say that that's a completely valid reason to want more money. And that in some ways we have used a kind of almost Puritanism when we've looked back at the 50s and at all of these strikes, which were often demands for more money. Sometimes they were demands for better working conditions or control of the shop floor. But I want to say that if a bunch of workers get together and say that they want something, that demand is likely to be valid and should be respected and honored.
And it sounds like a number of these films reinforce that idea. As you look at the whole body of work that you're reviewing about this period, are there some broad themes that you see coming out about workers, but also about unions?
Well, a theme that's very much something that the narrating class is interested in the decade is this conflict between labor and management. And, you know, a Marxist way to see it might be based in superstructure or the proletariat versus the owner class. But it gets formulated as labor management, almost as if these films are being made so that they can be screened in a business school context for how do you manage labor? How do you take care of your workers so that they won't strike so much? So that's sort of a theme. A theme is how are managers and workers supposed to relate to each other? I do think there is a theme of solidarity, and there's a theme of class solidarity that comes through these films. There is also a theme of consumerism, but it's a working class consumerism. Weirdly, Marty wants to own his own business. He doesn't own his butcher shop at the beginning of that story. And he and his mom live in this kind of old broke down house, and their dream is to live in an apartment, a nice apartment uptown. So what we kind of assume are middle class dreams, middle class fantasies, I think these films sort of frustrate and interrupt that. People want a little bit more, but it's not over the top. There's still kind of modest desires, but they're desires rooted in a kind of working class vision of being treated well, not having to work all the time, having basic boundaries around the working day. I mean, they're reasonable. It's the dream of a reasonably better life.
That's a great capsule for that. I was like, I want that on a t-shirt. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you mentioned Salt of the Earth earlier, which is a film that's famous for having involved working class people in the making of the film. There are a number of you know, local people who appear in the film and play roles in it. Are there other examples of places where working class people in a particular community or union members themselves were involved in the making of these films?
Yes. In The Whistle at Eaton Falls, lots of locals were cast, and they weren't cast in key roles. It's really a feature of what people think of as Italian neorealism, to use sort of the people in the place in those roles. Similarly, in Clash by Night, some of the cannery workers were cannery workers in that scene. In fact, all of them, I think, except for Marilyn Monroe. Similarly, in The Garment Jungle and actually on the waterfront, cast some of the dock workers in those kind of crowd scenes and background roles.
And was that ever featured as part of the marketing of these films? I mean, would viewers have known that? Would it have made a difference for how people saw these films in that period?
I don't think it made a difference to the random viewer, but it definitely made a difference to the people whose faces were actually on screen. So it was its own kind of almost not quite reality television, but an attempt to sort of put normal people in the film actually increases the buzz around the film for that community.
Right.
So there was some of that that was explicitly done.
Yeah, that makes great sense. So on the other side, I'm thinking about writers and directors. You mentioned Kazan earlier as one person who had been caught up in McCarthyism in the 1950s. And I know there were others in this era, some of the filmmakers who were involved in these kinds of films. How did that affect the way that workers and unions and class was represented in that period?
Well, certainly because of the blacklist, I think a lot of the people who would have been inclined to tell these stories are exiled. They're exiled from the country. They're exiled from the movie industry. So there's certainly a kind of sparser crop of progressives hanging around. Ironically, in the case of Kazan and Bud Schulberg, they wanted to make a film. They said in all of their correspondence with each other and in a lot of that data that I've looked at, they said they wanted to make a progressive film to prove that that basically people who named a name still had progressive politics. So there's a weird progressivism, I argue, that persists because even those who named names did not give up all of their values and allegiances in terms of the issues they cared about when they took that stance, and that naming names allowed them to stay in the business.
You know, that's fascinating, because one of the things I was wondering about is whether there are ways in which people were targeted under McCarthyism in part because they were making films like this. So that the Red Scare, in part, does it reflect a backlash against these ways of representing the working class? Are those things connected? Why somebody would be targeted in the first place?
That's been the argument of almost everybody who looks at this period. I think the way the Blacklist worked, it was a little more illogical. One of my hypotheses, and I don't have a smoking gun that proves this, is that the Blacklist emerges at a point when actors especially, and writers to a lesser extent, but that actors were going to have increasing bargaining power with television. Television was this big empty black hole that had to be filled, and it had to be filled with hours and hours and hours of storytelling and actors a day. So at this point when creative producers, actors, artists were going to have incredible bargaining power, I think the Blacklist served as a way to tamp down demand. Tamp down the demands that might be made by this emerging powerful class of artists in the age of television. So this is a hypothesis. I don't have somebody saying that in a letter, like, these pesky writers are asking for more, so let's blacklist them. But I think there's a kind of historical coming together of these two moments of an anti-communist fear combined with this rising power of a creative producing class because of television. So the one thing that we see in television with progressive writers is that they're able to get their stuff on TV because they'll put almost anything up on TV. So Paddy Chayefsky is one of the most successful writers of the period. He's in this group of about six other writers. They write in teams, and they write for these nighttime dramas sponsored by things like Silco. And they are able to demand increasing compensation for their work. And the advertisers hate them. They're like, this stuff is so depressing. These are all these ugly working class people. Why do we have to look at them? But they're the ones who are, they're able to produce. They are able to write scripts week after week after week and get them up. So I think there is a backlash against leftists in the industry, but I think that because culture is demanding so much more output, that this progressive stuff kind of keeps rolling along because it couldn't be shut out at a moment when television was so desperate for material.
So, Kathy, what's your theory about why that eventually dies down? Because certainly by the time we get into the 60s and 70s and more recently, we don't have as many films or television shows that really focus on workers. I mean, there's some over that period, but something must have changed near the end of that decade that shifts this. And if it isn't just the Blacklist, what kinds of things were going on that would have caused that change?
Well, I may be overly attached to my counterintuitive view of the world.
Aren't we all?
But I don't see this as trailing off.
Oh, okay. So just say more about that.
Well, I think...
Do you think this kind of lays a template that then gets followed over the next few decades?
Well, the things change a lot around the marketing. So television does get more, the marketing becomes more streamlined, more sophisticated. But you have figures like Norman Lear creating characters like Archie Bunker in the 60s, like I think some of this keeps going in the way that it happened in the 50s. But what I see when I look at 20th century media production writ large, there's almost nothing that passes muster for a progressive looking at a narrative about a union. Unions don't come out well in movies and TV across the board, almost across all the decades. There's a few exceptions. Silkwood, you know, I mean, Norma Rae, like you and I could name all of the exceptions. But what I want to argue is that working class people are constantly featured in film and television in the 20th century, 21st century, in ways that are respectful, in ways that get working class issues out, in ways that get working class issues talked about. But because they don't do what we want them to do and sort of promote solidarity and union membership, we don't think about those films and television shows.
So it's really more about how we watch them than it is about what's being made.
I think that's right. I think there is always culture being made about working class people from the kind of centers of power in Hollywood.
So let's bring that up to the present, because we certainly there's been a lot of attention in the last few years to the working class generally. And we've seen some films that I think seem, at least on the surface, to present a more progressive take on it. So I'm thinking about films like Boots Riley's Sorry to Bother You, or Parasite, which, you know, just recently won Academy Awards for both Best Foreign Film and Best Picture, that it seems clearly to be sympathetic in many ways to the working class family in that film. Are these signs that things are changing at all, or is it just that I'm going to those films looking for these things?
I think those films, you know, have always been there. I see what the thing that I see that's so extraordinary is there are more and more kind of high quality productions that are really telling these stories. So I'm teaching a class on inequality right now, and I gave the students a list of movies that they could choose from to write about. I'm talking about Hunger Games, which is, you know, a slightly lower brow take that certainly is a commentary, I think, on working class America through this kind of allegory. But I gave them Winter's Bone, which came out in 2010, Moonlight, Lady Bird, Manchester by the Sea, and Parasite. So all Academy Award winners of one award or another that have been made in the last 10 years. And so I think there's a lot of prestige now associated with some of these stories. But again, I think that's, I don't want to say it's always been true and that nothing has changed. I guess for me, what has been constant over the 20th and 21st century since the dawn of film is that filmmakers are sometimes drawn up from the working class, and that studios know that they have to get working class butts into the theaters to make a profit. And that is a constant that I see over cultural production, over the space of that film cultural production. And I think that what we have to do as people who love culture and who also love unions is that we have to see those movies through the eyes of the great mass of creators that come and put them together, many of whom do belong to unions themselves. So I want us to see them as collective productions that involve lots of working class creators, sometimes writers, sometimes actors who have those backgrounds, and to see the films as these complex, intricate documents that if we look more closely at them, will tell us more than we realize about the state of the working class today.
That, I think, is a brilliant place to leave this. So, Kathy, I want to thank you for taking some time to talk to me. This is great work, and I think really will help us think about what we look for and what we notice when we go to the movies. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry.
All right, great to talk to you. We will be talking again soon, I hope.
Yes.
All right.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Only 20 years from today.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT, and we hope you do, on your favorite podcast app. This week's music included Racing with the Clock and 7.5 Cents, both from The Pajama Game, a 1957 musical film starring Doris Day and Jack Straw, directed by George Abbott and Stanley Donen, with choreography by Bob Fosse. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozick, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time. Give it to me every hour.